This is The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to The Guardian Football Weekly. Harry Kane, the greatest individual performance by anyone ever in the history of football. Well, at least a pretty good one. His last gasp winner at the Etihad. And a brilliant match and an excellent weekend advert for the greatest league in the world. However disappointed Craig Paulson looked for that split second. Is the title race back on? Liverpool come from behind to beat Norwich with Sadio's scissor kick and Thiago's delightful passing. Blood, thunder and actual blood at Elland Road in a 1970s let the game flow cracker with Manchester United finally getting the better of a tiring Leeds. Burnley score three. How's about that then? Weghorst gives Sean Dyche hope. Also, does anybody want to pass to Romelu Lukaku? Has Stevie G's dip in form coincided with Frank Lampard getting a job in the Premier League? Will Arsenal ever get a penalty again? And is Chris Wood meowing at Kurt Zouma funny or really funny? Elsewhere, two decent results for England's women in the Arnold Clark Cup and a hat-trick of own goals for a Kiwi in the Shebelees Cup. We'll never get through all of it, but we'll try and we'll answer your questions on today's Guardian Football Weekly. On the panel today, Barry Glendenning, welcome.
Hi, Max. How are you?
Very good, thank you. I presume even more up for it than normal because he got stuck for hours in Leeds last night. Barney Ronay, welcome.
Hi, everyone.
It's a really good try, that. That's the best, the best you've ever done, Barney. Yeah, it really did. I feel like a coiled spring today. Also, live from a Holiday Inn in Norwich for his pod debut, going full Partridge, really going method Partridge. Commentator Seb Hutchinson, welcome, Seb.
Thank you for having me on. Fantastic.
Oh, no, it's a pleasure.
I was talking about the hotel.
Yeah. let's start at the Etihad. Manchester City 2, Spurs 3. Mark Langdon said, will he be leading on the City game? We got yelled at in the week for leading with PSG Real over City's win in Sporting Lisbon. We will lead with the City game because, Barry, it was a brilliant game of football.
Yeah, I said on Thursday there was three games I was looking out for this weekend. This was one of them, the Man U Leeds, one was the other, and West Ham Newcastle was the third. That wasn't great, but it was all right. But the City Tottenham game and Leeds Man U were brilliant. Everyone's been raving about Harry Kane's wonderful performance. He wasn't alone among Spurs players in doing extremely well, but he really stuck it to his brother, the agent, and Daniel Levy by pulling this performance out of the bag against City in a season where he hasn't, for long periods he's been pretty poor, but in this game he had... he was simultaneously playing as a striker and a deep-lying midfielder. He was excellent in both positions. He had, I think, four touches in the Manchester City box, and scored two goals, had one ruled out for an offside that wasn't his fault, and one brought a brilliant save out of the City keeper. I thoroughly enjoyed the game. I thought Spurs deserved to win and made life incredibly difficult for City, but you know, City, it could have gone either way, I think, but Spurs deserved the win.
And that's the thing about Kane's performance, Seb, isn't it, that you don't get many touches when you play Manchester City, so to do that many things without having too many touches is truly extraordinary.
Well, we know how football seems to work nowadays, because not everybody can keep across the match, not everybody can watch a game. So games often come down to highlights, and that's how people digest football. And if you were watching highlights of that game, you would have thought Harry Kane was totally unplayable for the entire 97 minutes in the end, that Tottenham dominated Manchester City, and every attack they looked like they could have scored lots and lots of goals. But of course, as you say, it was about efficiency, you know, and efficiency in attack from Tottenham in that particular game. But for me, the standout point, and I know this sounds strange, was to think how well Wolves and Southampton are playing at the moment. Because I'd covered Spurs' game the week before against Wolves, and they were terrible. And for some reason, it's amazing how these performances flip and flop, depending, of course, on the opposition. I think for Conte yesterday, he was in his element with the system he could put out against Manchester City. It worked perfectly. I thought that the game plan, Manchester City almost walked into it, and the template to beat Pep Guardiola's side seems to be the same for every team in the Premier League that does manage to beat them that isn't Liverpool, which is if you can get the bodies behind the ball, frustrate them, and you've got a really effective counter-attack, which Brentford didn't have in the game I saw them play against City a couple of weeks ago. But if you do, then you can cause the City side problems if you have that quality in attacking areas.
What did you make of it, Barney?
Oh, yeah, it was really good. And, you know, I agree with Seb that I mean, it's not as though Man City are clinging on there now. They've been found out. They've been busted. And frankly, it's a miracle they're still somehow managing to win games. But there is a thing which Antonio Conte did really well of how to play against them, which actually Maurizio Sarri did as well a couple of years ago, where you acknowledge their strengths and play on what weaknesses they have and defend very narrow. I think the key is to defend narrowly and deep so that you force them to cross the ball when they attack, which happened quite a lot. And obviously the one thing they don't have is a sort of target man type figure. And then hit the space behind the fullbacks, which Harry Kane admitted in his post-match interview that specifically talked about, and he then enacted exactly what Antonio Conte had told him to do. And in Kane, they have the perfect player to do that because his that thing he does of dropping back and playing those passes with both foot into those channels is absolutely designed to prey on that thing where there's space behind the fullback. So that was good. And Kane is amazing. I mean, I've got this theory that he's actually a really underrated player. The people, the common thing is to say he's overrated. Oh, people always go, Harry Kane, what's he ever won? But that's because people are obsessed with trophies. And if you see a picture of a celebrating person holding a shiny thing, you think that person is good and has done that thing on their own. But if you think that he's only ever played in essentially underperforming teams with this kind of psychological problem with winning, but has like England and Spurs, and he's improved those teams and has this astonishing record. I think that if he had played in, for example, Cristiano Ronaldo's Real Madrid team the same time Ronaldo was playing for them, he would have the same record. He would have the same goal-scoring record and the same trophies. I think he's that good.
It wasn't just Kane who played brilliantly, Seb, in this game for them. I mean, Kulusevski and Bentancur both looked really good. Kulusevski's kind of deceptive because he doesn't look quick or skillful, but he appears to be good at football.
He was one of those classic cases of a player coming into our league where you've got one half of people saying, oh, we should watch this talent. He's been highly rated for years. He's going to be fantastic. And other people writing him off after 20 minutes of an FA Cup tie against Brighton, one of the most forgotten FA Cup ties in history, it will go down as. And the thing with him is he's not particularly quick, but he is a player where you clearly see that there's a reason why Conte's happy for him to be there. He was disciplined in his performance. He defensively sometimes dropped into the back line, almost like a back six they made at points, mainly because Emerson Royale can't defend and can't be trusted to have any sort of defensive discipline whatsoever. So maybe he felt he needed that extra protection. But there were, for me, one of the standout players for Tottenham is Christian Romero, the heart of that defence. I mean, he's been out for so long with this injury picked up on international duty. He's come back into the side. And straight away, I know it can be seen as slightly easier for centre-halves, but he's just got on this run. And he wasn't at fault for the Wolves defeat particularly, you know. So I think that's a key part of it. And as we know with any team, if you can get that core together, and they do have quality up front, Tottenham. And when you look at this top four race, as it were, I'd probably say I think they've got the best manager of all the teams in that race. They are certainly the front runners for me in getting that position. But it is an interesting battle and some excellent displays in the Tottenham team.
Yeah, worth mentioning Eric Dier as well, who came back into the side and appears to be the only defender they have that actually talks out loud, which is kind of a key part of it. Bob says, can we discuss the look of disappointment from Craig Pawson's face when Kane scored the winner yesterday? It looked like he had a tenner on it, finishing 2-2 with Kulusevski to get the first goal at 66-1. And Neil says, how concerned should we be about the human race, given the reaction to a 5-second slow motion clip of a fourth official turning his head slightly after a goal was scored? Barry, are you on the conspiracy theorist side or the other side?
Very much on the other side. I hadn't noticed this until you mentioned it yesterday, so I had to go and check it. I'm in despair for the human race and have been for some time, regardless of how disappointed Craig Pawson looks when Tottenham score winners. But yeah, it's nonsense, of course. I think, but maybe he was disappointed. Maybe he was just remembering the ending to a sad movie he'd seen. I can't say for sure. Only Craig knows.
Well, I think I can explain his reaction, because you have to. It reminded me of being in the press box. Like, Craig Pawson thinks that the whistle's going to blow any second and his work will be over. It's incredibly nerve-wracking what he's doing. He's really stressed. He's watching everything. He's massively on show. He knows everyone's watching him. This is his work. It's going to be a draw. The whistle's going to go. That's good. It's over. Often when there's a late goal in the press box, you just hear these groans and horror and people slumping onto the desk because everything they thought was settled now has to be redone. Who knows, this event's going to have to be replayed. There could be another problem Craig Pawson has to intervene in. It was just, it's like if someone told you at the end of this podcast, you've got to record another half an hour of it because something else has happened. You'd be slumping down Craig Pawson, like, it's purely that's his job. He's not watching as a fan, and he's just...
I mean, to be fair, Barney, you're sort of slumping after about 2 minutes normally of this podcast. I mean, even getting I'm scared to even suggest that you might want to leave before the podcast is finished. But no, it's an interesting theory. Does that mean then, as James says, after writing off Liverpool's chances of the title, is it time to write them back on? Barry, do we write them back on now?
I think we'd written them back on even before this game because, if I'm not mistaken, they have a game in hand and they had a game against City to come. So even if City hadn't lost this game, it was still in Liverpool's hands, but now it's more in Liverpool's hands because of goal difference, I believe. So, yeah, we do have a title race. And I think, well, we have one for the time being anyway.
Seb, look, Norwich scared Liverpool, didn't they? They scored, but then Liverpool made changes as they did against Inter in the week. And they've got amazing depth. Thiago came on and was brilliant. And ultimately, they deserved that, I think, didn't they?
Well, I was at the Arsenal-Brentford game at the time and I saw the score flash up to say that Norwich were leading. And I think Efan Okoku was alongside me and I said, oh, you'll be interested to know that, you know, Norwich are leading at Anfield. And Efan said, why would I be interested in that? And I was like, didn't you used to play for them? He said, yeah, but, you know, professional and all of that.
He's only focused. Efan Okoku is so single-minded.
He was staring at Rico Henry. He was, you know, he was analysing that particular situation. And Arsenal did score about a minute later. So, you know, I should have been concentrating as well. But then from the moment after Arsenal scored and I looked back at to see what had happened and Liverpool had scored two quick goals, I think it goes back to that idea that if there was any other team in the Premier League chasing City at this point, you'd probably rule out the chances even with the games in hand. But Liverpool, just like City, are capable of going on these relentless runs that for many people, lots of people don't like it because they feel that, you know, you want to have that jeopardy in football. But, you know, you have to hand it to both these clubs in this particular situation that you can't rule Liverpool out in a season of, you know, it's the games in hand season. You know, this is that's quite irritating looking at the table, thinking, well, if this team wins their next three and if, you know, or Brentford are 7 points clear of Burnley, but they've, you know, but actually Burnley have got 20 games in hand, so maybe we can't rule them out of the title race and all this sort of stuff. It's just, it makes my head spin because obviously I'm in the business of permutations and you're trying to work out, well, currently the goal difference for Liverpool is better, but will it be after those games in hand? You know, this is the situation. But you could feel that collective, when City lose a game and they're in this sort of form, it feels like everybody's like, oh, the Premier League, it's back. It's back again. We can enjoy this again and everything else, which is harsh in a way on Manchester City because, you know, they want to win their games. You know, they're not going to start chucking games away just to make the tournament more interesting, competition more interesting. But to answer your question, I still feel City have that advantage simply for the fact that because they've got the points on the board.
Jordan Henderson, Barney, in this game was brilliant, and like with his pass, he played a key pass for the first goal, which set up Tsimikas for Mane's away kick, and a beautiful pass for Luis Diaz as well.
Yeah, he's a good player. Another sort of often slightly I think unfairly kind of belittled. But in their best years, in those two really great seasons, or two, three really great seasons they had, he was often really the leader in that team. I thought Thiago was a good game for him as well. This is exactly the kind of reason, the kind of team Klopp bought him for, really, to give him that other gear. And he's just such a nice player. It's really good to see him affecting them. And when everybody's fit, they're an incredible team. I mean, it's the one thing talking about a title race, the one shame is that Liverpool are the only team that's challenged Man City in the last 5 years. So it always feels slightly sort of false to say it's a, you know, wow, how exciting. Which one of these two teams, which are miles ahead of everyone else, might win the league this time? But it's still, I mean, it's great that they've been reeled in a bit and the league's not over. It's good for the product, and we all rely on the product.
Do you think, I don't know, there is another team, probably Chelsea, that should be challenging these other two, given the resources, the squad, the manager, all those things?
Yeah, of course. They have the players too. Although the problem Chelsea have is that they're always trying to make, they've got this incredibly, it's like you've got the, you know, a fridge packed with the most incredible ingredients that you've bought from, you know, the whole earth supermarket for £300, but with no clear recipe in mind. So you bring in a really clever, inventive chef to build something out of this weird collection of goods, and you come up with something that's quite good. Whereas the brilliance of City and also Liverpool is that their recruitment and everything speaks to the team on the pitch and to the exact system they want to play. So they're that much more coherent than Chelsea, which is basically a kind of very fancy kind of lucky dip of players. And it's just kind of, you can win cups on the hoof like Tuchel did by being brilliant, but they're not quite at the same level of internal coherence.
Could you say the same for Manchester United, do you think, Barney? Because except their chef isn't quite as good.
Yeah, I mean, there's a problem there with some of the ingredients are to be past their sell-by date, weird, not quite what you expect. Oh, this is made of goat's cheese. This thing's wrong. They've had some very weird chefs in, none of whom seem to know what the other one's doing. And the entire restaurant is being run by a bunch of sort of disconnected lunatics who are pulling in different directions. So I definitely wouldn't
eat
the
cast
there.
Of The Apprentice.
Yeah, it's like the place where Gordon Ramsay comes in and just ends up machine gunning everyone because he's so intensely frustrated after about 3 months of absolute nonsense. So, no, I'm not eating in that kitchen.
So what you're saying is they need to add rice to this recipe.
Oh, yeah.
Very good. I was wondering which chef did you like the least of these? I mean, obviously, you know, after a hard day's service and Mourinho comes in and then he just, in front of all the customers, just berates all the staff in front of him. Whereas, you know, when David Moyes was chef, it was all just a bit bland. The food just wasn't that great. And I mean, no one really remembers Van Gaal as a chef. And, you know, and then constantly people were questioning whether Solskjaer had only got the job in the kitchen because he once, what, ate a really good chicken schnitzel there in front of everybody else in 1999. Anyway, before we end part one, let's just cover off Chelsea. I've moved them up the running order because we were talking about them. They won 1-0 at Palace. Thomas says Lukaku only had 7 touches in 90 minutes. Who on the pod can pull a Lukaku and say only 7 words during the taping of this episode? There was a Europod, Barry, where you only said hello and goodbye. It was a planned thing, but I enjoyed it tremendously. Is only having 7 touches Lukaku's fault, or is it his teammates' fault, Seb?
Oh, I mean, I have to say it's got to be the structure of the team, because Lukaku, certainly at the beginning of last year, I was rating him as probably the best striker in the world. He seemed unplayable. He seemed a fantastic player in form, heading into the Euros. Every game I saw him and I thought, no defender can cope with this guy. He runs into the channel. He seems to have an advantage over every defender. The start of the season in the game against Arsenal away, he was, I mean, Pablo Mari, I think it probably led to him leaving the club for that very game in a sort of Senderos type way. But I think there's got to be an issue there somewhere. And I think the interesting point is obviously this interview he did in Italy, this weird system, and it almost makes you think, goes back to what Barney was saying in terms of when you bring players into your club, what are you doing with them in your structure? Or are you just bringing big names in just to say we're a big club and we can bring in whoever we want, we can attract whoever we want? Because it feels like it should be working for Chelsea, but maybe is he the wrong player for them in this position? Because he's certainly good enough to be scoring more goals than he has. And, you know, I was going to say, you know, in terms of touches in football, I don't think that should, you know, if you're efficient with Harry Kane, how many touches he had in the box and what he converted doesn't necessarily mean that you're having a bad game. You know, Boba Fett was a hugely successful character in Star Wars after five lines. And then all of a sudden people aren't so happy with him. Now he's got a bit more to say. So, yeah, Lukaku, you know, it's obviously in every scenario, it's a bit of both. But he is a player. He's a top, top, top draw player who should be getting more out of him, surely.
Mark says, when do Crystal Palace win games? Whenever I see them or check the result, they've not won. And yet they're never in the relegation zone. They probably had more of the chances, Baz, in this game, didn't they?
Yeah. They're a funny side, actually. They have played very well in some games earlier this season and not got the points returned they deserved. And I think this was another game where they at least deserved a point. And possibly deserved all three. Chelsea weren't on it. Tuchel put it down to jet lag, lack of sleep, players having colds after, due to the aircon on the plane on their way home from Abu Dhabi playing the World Championships, and that they hadn't played a Premier League game in a month or so, and a trip to Sellers Park on a filthy, dirty day in Saturday afternoon. I think they got away with this one, a late winner, and it's 3 points I think they possibly didn't deserve. But Palace, I am very impressed with them under Vieira. They have some terrific players and they just need to start turning good performances into better results.
All right then, that'll do for part one. Part two, we'll begin at Elland Road. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. So Leeds 2, Manchester United 4. Graham says, can we have all the pitches drenched to at least Elland Road standards from yesterday, please? It made for a nostalgic trip down bad pitch lane. I'm hoping for huge areas of sand next week. Steve says, if only there'd been a penalty so that Leeds could send a man on to repaint the spot and complete our fantastic journey back to the 70s. It did feel a bit like that. Loads of tackles flying in. Barney, you were there. Did you have a nice time?
Yeah, it was really good. It was like, they're right, Leeds, the whole of Leeds felt like a very stylized trip back into the past, like a cinematic version written by David Peace. And with kind of, some of it was almost too cliched. Like, why is it raining so much? You know, this sort of noir cliche. There were hundreds of police. The streets were packed. It was all very gloomy and exciting. And there's something about Elland Road because it has that metal corrugated roof and metal pillars everywhere, and it's very low. It has this kind of tinny reverberative quality when the crowd, it sounds like a BBC sound effect, like 1970s football crowd. It's, you know, on, I was trying to write about this in my report, it probably didn't come across, you know, on when you play a vinyl album and you get that particular kind of hiss and hum, and it's a warm sort of quality that's totally unrepeatable. You can't get that sound effect on digital sound. It's like that. It really just sounded very different. It was a kind of a Proustian. It was like taking a bite of grim 1970s Madeleine cake and mixing it with a little teaspoon of hate, and you were transported back to the 1970s or the 1980s maybe. But the game was brilliant, and yeah, I really enjoyed it. It was really good fun. And Paul Pogba was really good in the first half, even though his stats suggest he had a bad game and he did lose the ball a few times and stuff like that. But he did things that mattered. And then in the second half, this Man United team that's supposed to be full of cliques and lacking in spirit and leaks and everybody hates each other gave this incredible display of spirit on a day when you might have expected them to crumble and fall apart. You know, they've gone from 2-0 up to 2-2. But, you know, at the bottom, they're footballers who have intense kind of pride in the way they play. They would have responded on a kind of emotional, visceral level to that atmosphere. and football still gets in. The game comes back and takes over, no matter how much kind of nonsense we chuck at it. This thing survives. That those 11 people playing that game still feel that kind of urge to win. And it was an incredible game for many reasons.
Keelan, who's a Leeds fan, I like this question, said, what do you do after you know you've had the best 2 minutes of your life? I mean, they were quite an extraordinary couple of minutes, weren't they? I mean, the noise of that equaliser, Barney, sounded amazing. How was it in there?
Yeah, it was incredible because it had been really noisy all the way through. And then there'd be a kind of slight lull. And then the game kept spilling over. It kept spilling onto the pitch. You know, for some reason, players keep insisting on celebrating next to the crowd. I don't think it used to happen as much as it does. But actually, on that, can I just say something about behaviour? Because there's been this kind of hysteria about fan behaviour a lot recently. There's been a talk about cocaine at football, about, you know, the world's going mad, you know, people are out of control. Feral youth, you know, untamed feral youth is going crazy again, which is a kind of recurrent theme of mankind since kind of caveman times. But I've been to two games in the last week. One was QPR against Millwall, a London derby, where there were no real police presence. And then this one, which was really spilling over and very fraught and quite provocative. And even though some things were thrown, I watched very carefully and there were some objects thrown. That's bad. Someone got hit. Really, this kind of stuff has been going on forever. If you walk through a city centre on a Friday night, it's likely to be far more dangerous than going to a football match. And I'm actually sort of, I want to emphasise how restrained people really are, how little actual disturbance and violence there was yesterday, even though we put it under a microscope and had people there primed to report on it, looking for hooliganism and society's falling apart. Why isn't everyone doing cocaine and fighting? But people didn't do that. And it was the same at Millwall, this London derby. There were no police there and everybody just behaved pretty well. Some kids ran on at the end and then ran off because the stewards told them to get off, and that was that. And football supporters had not sort of feral nightmares. They actually behaved pretty well, given the weird forces of rage, anger, and excitement swirling around these occasions. So that's what I wanted to say. And while it was a brilliant atmosphere, it never at any stage felt dangerous or out of control.
We should say that in a statement, West Yorkshire Police said today they made a total of 9 arrests following the match. They said that while there was no significant disorder and no injuries were reported to any players or fans, they said offences including public order, throwing of missiles and breach of banning order took place. The FA have also confirmed they're investigating after Anthony Elanga was struck by an object thrown from the crowd. Seb, back on the pitch and to the game, what did you make of Leeds?
I have to say with Leeds, that I suppose Leeds supporters must be slightly sick of the fact that every other team or football fan says, I love watching Leeds games. Oh, they're so great to watch. Oh, every game you get goals, goals, goals. Well, I think that would only be good for Leeds if they were actually picking up points from those results. And there's a slight, you know, I think football fans can be caught in. I like those games every now and again, but I wouldn't mind the sort of feeling of just rolling teams over that Manchester City do every week and other teams being unhappy about that fact. I think most football fans, they just want their team to win in whatever way they do.
Barry, do you think we need to credit Manchester United? We've been quite critical of them to sort of win this game twice. Actually, as Barney alluded to, sort of showed a sign of character and something that they can build on? Or was it just Man United are a bit weird and they showed both sides of that?
No, they deserve credit because the two quick-fire goals they conceded, I expected them to crumble and go on to lose, and they didn't. They regrouped, they won, they showed character, and hats off to them for that. The next month is critical, I think, for them going forward, a phrase I hate, and for this season in particular, that they've the two legs against Atletico Madrid. They have to play Watford and then Man City, Spurs and Liverpool. So that's going to, I suppose, make or break them this season.
Barney, you picked out Jadon Sancho, who had a very good game.
Yeah, he was really good. That was really nice to see him. And you forget, he's still only 21. He's never played in the Premier League before. He's thrown into this kind of slight madhouse of a team with a manager who I don't think particularly wanted him or saw him as part of his future plans at the beginning of the season. And he just needs to be pointed in the right way. I mean, what I understand from people being told who people by people who know, is that at Dortmund, what worked for him was that he had this very, very clear attacking plan. He was literally told what to do. And he wanted that direction. He soaked it up. It was basically, his runs were pre-scripted. Do this. At this point, they went through very careful drills. Whereas when he got to United, he was basically told, you know, go out and play. Go on, son. You know, go and show us what you can do. And that was a change for him. And it took him a long time to get used to it. It has taken him a long time. And if you just wind him up and point him the right way, he's got so much talent. He's really relentless. He can do lots of different things that work. And he's just a really efficient player. I really like him. And I really hope this is the start of, he's never played in an occasion like that before. And to come out of it so well was really encouraging. I really hope he goes on from here because I really like him as a player.
Worth pointing out Robin Koch and his concussion and the blood pouring from his head and the fact that he was allowed to play on. And then he went down again and was taken off. Clearly concussion substitutions, they do exist, but they aren't working. Barry, I mean, if you can get on your high horse again, but I feel we've said this a million times. And
well, the only thing I would add, Max, is we've had this before this season. One that springs to mind is Ruben Neves and Max Kilman, the Wolves player, clashing heads in a game against City. They were both allowed to continue. Neither of them went off for a concussion sub, and Max Kilman clearly shouldn't have been allowed to continue, possibly both of them. Now, we always look to rugby as the example for this, but in rugby recently, we've seen on two occasions, it was under 20 Six Nation game between England and Italy. An England player, Diago Bailey, went down, thumped his head off the ground, and the England doctor cleared him to play, but the independent doctor they have at rugby matches, whose job it is to assess these injuries, said, no, I want to give him an assessment. And the England doctor argued with the referee, going, I'm a doctor, I don't need a second opinion, I've cleared him to play. But anyway, and then a couple of days later, the England player in the England senior game against Italy, Jack Noel, cleared himself to play after suffering a head injury, but ultimately had to go off for a head injury assessment and never came back on the field. So rugby is held up as the beacon football should aspire to, but it's not working particularly well in rugby either, but they do have a better system.
Joe says, can Barney give some detailed explanation on the Leeds barge debacle? Sounds like it could rival a Ben Fisher story. Were you stuck on a barge?
No, there was a barge stuck underneath the train station, which sounds sort of so ridiculous, like a sort of hallucinogenic dream that I must have had standing on the concourse. But there's a canal that runs under there, and it was absolute raging rapids last night. It was actually really sort of quite frightening, and you thought there could be some major flooding. And they cancelled loads of trains. And I was told by a fireman that a barge had become lodged underneath the train station, which is quite worrying. And that it was chaos, actually. I got home at, I don't know, whatever, 3 a.m. or something, having left my house at 8 a.m, because it was just so chaotic. And it seemed to fit the gloomy Yorkshire Gothic nature of the whole day that should happen. I know storms don't apparently have anything to do with climate change, some people will say, but it did feel a little bit like the world was falling apart yesterday. We just needed a war in the Ukraine to start, and the picture would have been complete.
You didn't notice the Sky News editor Florence Sneed messaged you, Barney, to say, hi Barney, I hope you're okay, sounds like a bit of a nightmare. Do you know how long the boat has been stuck for, and is it something you can see or info coming from the station staff? This could have been a big moment for you, Barney.
Oh, I didn't know about that. I mean, Florence Sneed she's always messaging me. She's always worried how I am. You know? I'll say I've had a slightly different, difficult morning or something. She'll get in touch and say, what was it like, this slightly different? Do we mind if we use this on a, you know, she's doing it all the time. So thanks, Florence. I really appreciate it.
Right, let's rattle through a few more of the Premier League games then. Brighton nil, Burnley 3. John said, should Manchester City have signed a proper number 9 in the summer, such as Wout Weghorst? He got 20 league goals for Wolfsburg last season. And Barry, he was superb, wasn't he?
Yeah, he could be a brilliant signing if they can keep him fit. I don't think it's fair to say he's better than Chris Wood, but They got him for half the price. They sold
Why do we have to compare them? Why can't we just enjoy them both?
But I think he may bring more to the Burnley party than Wood did. And Wood hasn't had a brilliant start to his career at Newcastle. But Weghorst, I think he scored one goal in two games, over 150 games for Wolfsburg. He isn't just a big lump, you know, lump of a target man. He Burnley seemed to have, I don't know if it was for one game only against a very poor Brighton side, but very poor in the afternoon. But Burnley seemed to be building their game around Wout, and I look forward to seeing what more he can do. I think he'll be a very, very good signing if he stays fit.
Actually, their first goal was beautiful football. They're 19th, Seb, 17 points. They have got, as you were talking about the games in hand earlier, two games in hand on everybody, three games in hand on Norwich, only one game in hand on Everton. That's only their second win of the season. Like, two wins in 22 is categorically not good, is it?
No, it's not. I mean, one thing about this game that warms my heart is just seeing Aaron Lennon score. I think he's just one of those, that age of player, when you still see them performing. I think it's the James Milner thing as well, where you just think, oh, that brings me back to the, you know, the Premiership days and the last echelons of that particular stage of Premier League history. I thought I'd touch on that because I think that's his second goal in this season as well. So he's obviously playing a
part. Yeah, lovely finish too.
Lovely finish. And I love the Maxwell Cornet saga to Burnley as well. The fact he probably turned up and thought he was in Manchester and everything else. Just brilliant. But Burnley, the games in hand really do bother me and makes it really hard to judge the situation, because a hefty four games in hand on the likes of Brentford, it's really tough to gauge where they sit. I think they certainly won't finish bottom of the league. But to me, it seems like it's whether Burnley can finish above Brentford, because I think Newcastle have got enough of a head of steam here to rack up the points necessary. To me, it's a battle between Burnley and Brentford in terms of which of those two sides stays up.
Burnley are playing Spurs on Wednesday night, I think. They're going to win that, aren't they? Because there's no way Spurs will pull two victories in a row out of their ass. After that tremendous performance on Saturday, they're guaranteed to lose against Burnley.
Just to add to what Seb said about Aaron Lennon, the last time, just to tie it together in a kind of narrative circle, the last time Leeds hosted Man United in the Premier League in front of a crowd, it was in 2003 when Roy Keane scored the winner and loads of weird old players you've forgotten about. David Batty was playing. And also playing in that game was Aaron Lennon and Cristiano Ronaldo, who still hadn't scored a goal for Man United yet and was still this kind of hot-headed winger who everyone booed. And they were both playing in that game and both played yesterday, which is actually an amazing feat of longevity for both of them. And somehow Lennon is still really quick. I don't know how he's managed that. Because he looks after himself.
Mr. Leonard says, is it time to truly recognise the work Frank Lampard is doing at Everton? There aren't many coaches out there that can get Shane Long scoring. Yes, Southampton 2, Everton 0. And Everton are fascinating, aren't they, Barry? I mean, It's such an interesting appointment with Lampard. They had one really good game. Was it in the FA Cup? And you think, they've got this. This will work. And then it's sort of every other game, isn't it? So it's sort of every other pod we can say, they're brilliant, they're terrible, they're brilliant, they're terrible. And we'll just do that forever.
Well, this was a pitiful performance. I think Southampton had 11 shots on target. Everton had none. And I think if he took Everton down, that could have catastrophic consequences on Lampard's future in management, because a lot of, you know, Everton just don't get relegated. They've never been relegated in my lifetime, to the best of my knowledge, unless it happened when I was a very, very young boy. And they've come close once or twice, but generally they're pretty good. They're seventh, they're tenth. This performance was hideously bad. And if I was an Everton fan, I would be very, very concerned.
The thing about Lampard is I already get a feeling of he's one of those managers who's more interested in his how he, him and his brand and his reputation relates to that team than in just going all in to try and make that team work. You see this with Mourinho in the last few years. Every team he takes over, there's a point where suddenly he starts making excuses and talking about how it's not his fault. And for Lampard to be already doing that, to be, you know, when you're a manager, you, now that it's so important to make the players love and believe in you, unless you're some sort of Pep Guardiola tactical genius who can basically do whatever he wants and is so powerful, Lampard's already saying, well, this is why the players are in that, they're in that position, you know, this is, he's already distancing himself from the performance and from the players after a month. I mean, why does he think he got the job? He got the job because they play like that. That's why you've been lucky enough to get this job, Frank. And you have to get the players to believe in you. You can't start distancing yourself from what they do on the pitch. And both Southampton goals were typical Southampton goals. And one was a high turnover. They ran through and scored. The other one, they just ran through Everton's midfield. And it was... You have to take some responsibility for that as the manager of how the players are playing. I found his interview after the game really depressing. I thought that's really not the way to do it. And brand Lampard is not as important as trying to get these players to play for you, whether you mean it or not. Antonio Conte has swallowed his... He wants to say so many things about these Spurs players that he can't say. He is so desperate to tell the truth and dish the dirt, but he's at least smart enough to realise that that is not going to work. And while that may protect Antonio Conte, it will do nothing for Spurs. And he needs to learn from that. He really does.
All right, that'll do for part two. We'll round up the rest of the Premier League and do any other business in part three. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. At the London Stadium, West Ham 1, Newcastle 1. Creditable draw this, Barry, for Newcastle, especially with that Trippier, Callum Wilson and Sam Maximum.
Yeah, and Javier Manquillo was out as well. Not as big, high profile an absence, but I think a draw was probably a fair result. It's a valuable point for Newcastle, who will have been horrified to see Watford and Burnley win, but West Ham's big problem is Mikel Antonio. He's either injured or he's not injured but looking tired because they don't have anyone else to play instead of him and can't rest him. But I was very impressed with Ryan Fraser in this game because he's career at Newcastle got off to a very inauspicious start, and a good result for Newcastle under the circumstances.
Steve says, did Barry slag off Joe Linton on a pod that I missed? How is he suddenly relatively good at football? Hugh says, can you think of any bigger transformation than Joe Linton's from not hit a barn door striker to midfield general? It's straight. There was one moment, Seb, in that game where he sort of ran through like Declan Rice runs through in centre mid. And you think, how has this happened?
It feels like Joe Linton's a project, really, at Newcastle, where it's strange how, you know, teammates come out and defend him in post-match interviews and fans have T-shirts on with his face peppered everywhere. And he's been changing positions. He's signed as this striker from the Bundesliga, and then he comes into the league, doesn't score a goal in 40 matches yet. Steve Bruce is playing him every week. We must be missing something about his game. And you think, what am I missing? I'm not seeing it at all. And all of a sudden, he's now some incredible reverse Beckenbauer type individual. I find it's amazing how football produces this. But I also have to credit the sort of mental fortitude of some of these players, because obviously in Joe Linton's case, he's coming into a foreign country, a foreign part of the country to people coming from abroad. And they've really taken him under their wing, really, in Newcastle. And they have that ability with the players that, you know, they attach themselves to individuals in Newcastle because they're always looking for that hero at the club, because they're a club that isn't fighting for trophies, which seems like it could be changing in the near future. One other note about that game, I thought one bit that stood out to me was Joe Willock, who's obviously been struggling for goals since he signed permanently. He went on this amazing run in the first half. I think he got past Declan Rice, he beats a couple of men, charging towards the penalty area. And you could tell in this highlights age, you could see it going through his head that, oh, I could go alone here and score a screamer and I'd be remembered and I'd be moving to Manchester United for 50 million next summer and all of this sort of stuff. But he had to pass it to his left. I can't remember who the player was, but he had to. And then he passed it and the cross was poor and it came to nothing. And this, the disappointment on his face was palpable. He just thought, oh, poor bloke, poor bloke. But he did score, so not too, don't feel too much for him.
Villa nil, Watford won. A big win for Watford. Robin Cowan, friend of the pod, was commentating for Match of the Day. He said, I know you won't have much time for Villa-Watford. How right you are, Robin. But Villa got well and truly Hodgsoned. That is all you need to know. And Vandalay Industries says, given how Aston Villa's fortunes have turned since Lampard took over at Everton, is this a definitive proof that Gerrard and Lampard cannot do anything together? Should Villa fire Gerrard and hire Scholes and Carrick to see if that works? You sort of do think, Barry, though, that if Roy can sort out Watford's defence, they do have good attackers. Like, it could somehow work.
Yeah, Josh King, Emmanuel Dennis, Shmila Sarr, all good players, all played well in this game. I no doubt Roy probably can sort out the defence. My concern would be if he can sort it out in time. I've never attended it or seen a Roy Hodgson training session, but I've heard lots about them. Apparently they're incredibly tedious, incredibly dull to be involved in. There are lengths of rope involved where he ties, you know, the back four together and nobody's allowed to break the line. But it Roy knows what he's doing, and whether or not he can do what he does in time to keep them up, I don't know. Time will tell.
Time will tell. Arsenal 2, Brentford 1. You were there, Seb. Talk us through it. Briefly, ideally.
Yeah, briefly. Well, there's not much else to say besides the fact that Arsenal were dominant. Their young players coming to the fore again. Brentford don't look like they can score a goal at the moment, which is a real worry for them. They carried the odd counter-attacking threat, but a lot of that came down to mistakes from Arsenal at the back. But it was a dominant first half in which they probably should have had a couple of penalties. Second half, the Smith Rowe in the place of Martinelli suspended, came and scored a lovely goal. Once Arsenal got their second goal, the game seemed to just coast away to a finish. And really, the most interesting talking point, besides, you know, the young players playing well in that game, was when Lacazette came off, took the armband, Xhaka refused to take it, then Nketiah came on, tried to give it to Granit Xhaka, who again refused to take it. Then Nketiah had the armband on for a minute or so, seemed really confused and perplexed and thought, this is too heavy on my arm. And he was desperate to give it to somebody. And then finally gave it to Kieran Tierney, who did the whole expression of, oh, me? Oh, you want to give it to me? Oh, okay, only if I take it. And afterwards, I think Arteta explained that Xhaka was pointing out that you need to give it to Kieran Tierney. But watching it live, it seems to me that either they weren't speaking the same language to each other, because I don't understand how you can say to someone, give it to that teammate of yours over there wearing that number that you've seen them wear all season, and it somehow take them a minute to get it to them. Maybe footballers are so disciplined that they need to stay in position that Nketiah thought, I can't go over to the left back area until the ball goes out of play to hand this armband that I'm flailing around on the pitch. But yeah, Arsenal do look a good unit when everybody's fit, and You just wonder really that the other sides around them have just maybe that more consistency over the end towards the end of the season, but they're definitely in the mix for the top four, no doubt.
There is this conspiracy theory amongst Arsenal fans, Barry, about all referees, and I thought they should have had a couple of penalties in this one. John Moss and VAR gave neither of them. One Lacazette was taken out, and one there was a handball, very similar to the Romero handball in the City Spurs games. I feel like the conspiracy theorists have really been given something to cling on to here.
Well, possibly. They definitely should have had two penalties. I don't really care whether they get them or not. I'm quite certain there is no conspiracy against Arsenal, but I am enjoying the conspiracy theories because quite a lot of people who I know respect and have a lot of time for are completely wrapped up in the conspiracy theory. One I'm going to single out is a former friend of the show, well, still friend of the show, formerly of this parish, Mr. Matt Scott.
he really has. Yeah.
He's lost his mind over this. Yeah, and, you know, he's an otherwise sane, very likable bloke, but he has completely gone full tinfoil hat on this, and I am loving it. And he is one of at least four people I know and respect and know to be quite sensible, intelligent people who have just lost their shit over this. It's great.
Jack Wilshere on the subject of Arsenal is going to play in the Danish Super League. Soren says, Jack Wilshere's transfer to Aarhus Gymnastik Forening is mind-blowing. Can you please get Barry to say Aarhus Gymnastik Forening?
Aarhus Gymnastik Forening. I only heard about this first thing this morning. Apparently he's playing for $6,500 a week, which is obviously a lot of money, but not by Jack Wilshere standards. And if he can stay fit, which he probably won't, it's a great signing for them. I know nothing about Aarhus, but yeah, good luck. It'd be interesting to see what happens.
Nobody say it's in the middle of our street. I think it's been done. Wolves 2, Leicester 1, finally. Some real weather there on Sunday. Daniel Pedence was very impressive, wasn't he? Brendan Rodgers said Leicester deserves something more. And I think Sebi was probably right, wasn't he?
Do you know what? He probably is right, but I just have to give credit to Wolves again. I just think what they've done this season is quite extraordinary, really. They're tough to score against. They do have quality in attack. And it's credit to them again that Southampton, who have also, we didn't get to mention them before, but they're on an excellent run. And every time I see them, they look impressive. And they've only lost one game in the last 2 months, and that was to Wolves. So I know you were asking me more about Leicester there, but I have to, because I think we always sometimes concentrate on the loser of the game. But we have to, in this moment in time, give credit to Wolves and to Southampton, because these are teams that I feel playing as well as anybody in the league at the moment.
Fine. Thank you so much. Succinct. It's what we wanted. Worth mentioning, Kasper Schmeichel frantically running back after he'd gone up for a corner. And I think Pedro Neto was bearing down a goal and Schmeichel was chasing him sort of like a Scooby-Doo baddie with his arms out and couldn't quite get there. It ended up in nothing. Rivers says, don't use even try recording the next podcast without detailing how Rangers just scudded Dortmund in Germany. Ewan Murray is on the pod on Wednesday for a professional Fitbar corner. Briefly, can we discuss the Arnold Clark Cup? Seb, you were commentating on England women against Spain yesterday. They had a good result there. They had a good result against Canada, both draws. First of all, can you just explain what the Arnold Clark Cup is?
So the Arnold Clark Cup is a tournament effectively put together by Pitch International. The idea of it is really just to give England some competitive games. And by that, I mean they've just had the qualifiers before Christmas. Very one-sided affairs. The last one, a 20-0 win, which was a pretty difficult game to commentate on because people are accusing me of being happy about goals being scored, which is quite a bizarre concept. How dare I get happy about England scoring goals because another team is well below the level. But it was designed really to get some of the best teams in the world, competitive preparation for those playing in the Euros as well. And it's played out that way. There have been really competitive matches, only 5 goals scored in the 4 games so far. And England's first half against Canada was the best I've seen them play for a long, long time. But a reminder also that the opposition is good and they will come back into the game. And it's a challenge for England to adapt to that. But the purpose of the tournament is, as I said, and it's certainly played out that way.
I mean, you're right. I mean, the first half against Canada was Millie Bright scored a brilliant goal. I've been quite critical of her before, but it was a brilliant finish. I mean, Janine Becky's goal for Canada was also absolutely brilliant. And then it looked like a sort of fair result, the goalless draw with Spain. You know, England had a few chances, probably more chances, but Spain had some decent chances late on.
Yeah, I mean, England played effectively a second string side. Serena Wiegmann's trying to rotate the squad. Obviously, when you've got 3 games in 6-7 days, whatever it is, and clubs to think about and everything else. I have to say my standout moment, though, of the game was in Carrow Road. I think nearly 15,000 people were in there, and the person over the announce system said, yeah, and the player of the match as decided by the ITV commentary team, and then for some reason repeated that again. The ITV commentary team is, and then they named the Spanish player Athenia del Castillo, and the crowd completely booed because they wanted it to be an England player in Hannah Hampton who'd had a decent debut, which I thought was quite a funny element of it. But otherwise, it has been, and for anybody who does get a chance to watch it, it's a really top class example of where women's football at is at the moment, and the tactical battles between the different nations it's a real credit to the coaching going on and the evolution as well. And certainly in the England team, I think Serena Wiegmann is a fantastic coach, and they're only going one way under her, but so are lots of other nations.
While we're on women's football, the She Believes Cup is happening over in the States. The USA beat New Zealand 5-0. Three of their goals were a perfect hat-trick of own goals from Michaela Moore, who plays for Liverpool, which is quite extraordinary achievement. I mean, it must be, as obviously, you can't imagine how bleak that is for her. And, you know, to do it all in the first half and then get hooked. But to somehow score a hat-trick of own goals and a perfect hat-trick is, Barry, sensational.
Yeah, I've seen the goals. Your heart goes out to Michaela. I don't really want to riff on her obvious anguish anymore. I presume she was hooked because, to borrow a phrase from Jamie Redknapp that I like, her head must have been absolutely in the tumble dryer on, you know, the fastest spin available. It's remarkable. Hopefully at some point in the future, she will be able to see the funny side. I do wonder if, I think it would have actually been funny and maybe taken some of the heat out of the situation if she was given the match ball signed by both teams after the game, because Christ almighty, what? I cannot imagine how awful she must have felt.
Well, Adam Hurry did tweet, does that mean the match ball gets to put her on its mantelpiece? Is that how it works? And that'll do for today's pod. Thank you, Barney. Thanks for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks, Barry.
You're welcome.
Excellent debut, Seb. Thank you.
Thank you. It's been a unique, newsworthy and mildly amusing experience.
Just mildly. All right. Cheers, mate. Yeah. Right. This is the Guardian Football Weekly. It was produced by Silas Gray. The script editor was me, basically. The executive producer was Max Sarnason. Thanks for listening. We'll be back on Wednesday.
This is The Guardian.